All right, in Acts chapter 16, then we're down to where Paul has cast the demon out of the servant girl. So we're down in, we ended up essentially at verse 18 there, where Paul says, "I charge thee in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her," and it came out that very hour. That's where we'll start off. First, I want to bring up this map again, of course, that shows the second preaching journey of Paul and Silas, Timothy, Luke, and others that were with him. You can see here that, and this is from, I think this is from PC Study Bible. This is the one where I don't see a copyright notice here. But, so it came out of some particular map book. This is the one that says Luke joins Paul and points to Philippi or Neapolis. Well, that's a little strange. That's not when Luke joined Paul. Luke joined Paul at where?
Troas.
We can see that the things that are put together by men don't exactly always line up the way that the Bible does. So we had discussed about the fact that Paul and Silas were beaten and jailed after a miracle, and we got down. We were talking about the slave girl who was exploited that had the demon, and that she was the person with the right message, but she was the wrong messenger, and that the apostles then healed her. And of course, in verses 18 and 19, it mentions that that's where they lost their method of income, lost their source of profits. Verse 19, it says their hope of gain was now gone. Well, I had looked over here at the fact that they had cast the demon out of this girl, and I thought about something that it just reminded me of in Mark the 5th chapter in verses 1 through 17. That's where Jesus went over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and he met the man that was possessed with the legion of demons, and he cast out the demons, and what did they do? They went into the pigs. They're like sheep, but a little bit different. Yeah, and the pigs did what? All ran down into the Sea of Galilee and drowned themselves. I'm not sure what that exactly is supposed to mean, but in verse 17, it says the people from that area then started gathering around him, came over, and they had seen that he healed this man from the legion of demons, and that also that he had cast the demons out into the swine, and they ran into the sea. And it says in verse 17, they began to beseech him to depart from their borders. And so here's another place where a miracle was performed, and ultimately somebody didn't like it. Not that it's the same, but it's just a sort of a comparison. We see that not all miracles are loved by everybody that's around them. If you can think of any others, I don't know. I'm trying to think of some others, but I didn't right off the bat.
The friends who lowered the gentleman through the roof on the pallet, we hope that maybe they put it back, but that might be possible.
That's right. Yeah. Somebody did bring up in class one time, well, they put a hole in his roof. Did they fix it? The Bible doesn't say whether they fixed it or not, but one can only hope. Yeah, Mickey.
You could also throw in there, related to that, the Pharisees had great problems with miracles Jesus did on the Sabbath.
That's true, yeah. So there were a number of objections to his miracles being performed on the day of the Sabbath. So
the reason for some objecting seems to be somewhat varied, at least in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Some objected to, for example, performing miracles on the Sabbath day because they just saw some reason to accuse him. I think in the instance you noted in Mark chapter 5, it very well may be they were just simply afraid.
Yes, they were, sure. That's what it looks like.
And when you look at the illustration of Acts 16th chapter, someone, that might have been Randy or someone, was reading from a translation that instead of using the word soothsaying that we have here in the American Standard translation used the expression called fortune teller.
Fortune teller? Yeah.
So you can see how this would be a source of profit for those who own the woman.
Right.
So she would sell the ability, of course, to people to buy the fortune that she would tell them. And that was a source of gain. So they were upset. You know, here's an investment. Now it's gone. They bought this slave woman, obviously,
yep.
to try to make money. And now their source of money is gone. So the reason for the objections seems somewhat varied.
Yes, that's true. And I think ultimately it came down to the scribes and the Pharisees objecting to Jesus' miracles because the Romans would come and take away their place and their honor, or whatever it was. But,
they just didn't like him.
They didn't, no, well, they didn't like him, that's true. Yeah, you can't do that because we don't like you. So that's anyway, I thought I would just bring that up because that's interesting, is that just because a person performs a miracle and something beneficial happens because of that, not everybody is on board with it, as it were. All right. So they healed her, or Paul healed her, cast the demon out of her, and of course the masters then lost their profit. And we discussed a bit about the right message and the wrong messenger last week. We see that's the case in several instances within the Bible, that even though the right message was given, the messenger was the wrong person. We go on now to the fact that these people that owned this slave girl now accuse Paul and Silas as Jews with unlawful teachings. Now, we go reading through here, we don't see that they say anything. All they do is say these people are Jews, so what they do is they start off prejudicing the people to begin with, saying, implying that these people are evil because they're Jews, period. Then they say that they teach things that are contrary for us to, not lawful for us, in verse 21, not lawful for us to receive or to observe being Romans. But at least in the text here, we have nothing that says what that might have been. Randy?
It appears they believed what the slave girl said. What she said was, these men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation.
Yes.
Those were strange words to their ears.
Well, yes, true. Yeah.
And apparently, they believed her because she's a fortune teller.
Okay.
So now they're saying, it's interesting that they don't accuse, they drag them before the authorities, but they don't accuse them of taking away their hope of profit. They accuse them of teaching wrong.
Right, right. Corey?
If you take this from a Roman perspective, they're claiming to be servants of the Most High God. The Most High God would have been Caesar.
We see the term Most High God used in a number of places throughout the Bible. You see it in the Old Testament and in the New. When we see the proper definition of it, we understand that it refers to Jehovah God. But yes, they may be, when she says Most High God, she may be referring to somebody else, though the demon appears to have been talking about God the Father, just from the context. But that's a good point that they would have considered the Most High God to be something other than perhaps what these people were talking about. Mickey.
The attitude of the various nationalities toward the Jews is interesting to me, because all they're looking for is simply an accusation. And there may be some credibility to the accusation, though it be skewed. For example, in Ezra's day, when the letter was written by King Artaxerxes to these people are bad people, we need to get rid of the Jews and destroy the Jews. Well, those lie. They were accused in Ezra 4 in verse 12 as being a rebellious people. They're from a bad city. They prepared the foundations of the city of Jerusalem that had been destroyed because these people were such bad people. And then closely related to that, I think in time, you find the same accusation made by Haman in the book of Esther.
Right.
These people were just bad people, and we need to get rid of them. And now here you've got Paul and Silas, they're teaching, obviously, things that would be somewhat different from the culture of the Roman Empire. So they're bad people. We've got to get rid of them.
And they accuse them of being Jews. But if you would ask them, are they Jews? No, they're Christians. But what did the people in the Roman government think of the Christians at that time? They were just a sect of the Jews, right? As far as they were concerned, it's just because in a couple of times in the New Testament, it's called this sect. And so a sect is just a section, just a piece of something. So... yeah, it's there's a lot of accusation going on here simply because they're Jews, and historically that's something that has occurred from throughout history in the Old Testament and the New. And the point that somebody brought up, perhaps it was Randy, no, one of the Randys, that they don't mention to the magistrates and to the judges that their money's now gone. They mentioned that these people are doing evil things that are contrary to Roman law. Apparently, it wasn't contrary to Roman law to take their money away, because that's what Paul did, was to take their money away, or their means of gain. But that's not mentioned in any of the accusations against Paul and Silas. It's just mentioned that people are doing things contrary to the Roman government. Jonathan?
I don't know if you mentioned it last week, or made a comment about the fact in verse 18 that she did this for many days. And being a servant, they would have been following her around, or they probably would have been with them. But if she's spending her time following these, there's the likelihood that they were trying to either exploit something for Paul or Silas or something, but she was spending so much of her time following them around. That was also affecting their business and their trade, trying to draw something in. But regardless of that side of it, they would have heard what Paul and Silas had to say. And many of the things, like we see in the next chapter in 17, Paul does state, this is different than what you Romans believe, or you Greeks believe while he was there in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
This is very different. I'm going to teach you about the God that you really don't know yet.
Right, the unknown God. Yeah.
So, for several days, they were something similar to that.
Yeah, she certainly wouldn't give up, would she? And so she was following them around, and yes, they were most likely with her because that would be the way that they would make their money. Oh, well, here she is now, you know, give us a few denarii, and she'll tell you what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. So, the interesting thing, somebody pointed out in one of the commentaries, is that, as you say, these men that are with the slave girl probably would have heard what Paul and Silas and the others had to say as they were preaching the gospel. And what did they just see? They just saw a miracle where a demon was cast out. And what do they say? He took our money away. Not, what must I do to be saved? So, an interesting thing here. I mean, it's a characteristic, I guess, or a response that we see many times throughout the Bible. You have the opportunity to take upon you salvation, as it were, and you decide to take upon you money or something else.
John was talking about politics. It really has to change. The very fact that some might listen and be persuaded by a miracle does not necessitate that they're going to continue to be persuaded by the miracle. We've got an illustration of that in John chapter 6.
Right.
When they saw the sign of the feeding of the 5,000, verse 14 of that chapter says that they believed him to be the Christ. Well, that was the purpose of the miracle. But if you just keep reading in that chapter, they want to see another miracle so they can believe that he's the Christ.
What do you show us?
Yeah.
What?
Very frustrating. That chapter, very frustrating.
It is. Yes, that's right. Bruce?
You know, this kind of reminds me of setting stage of the next thing is going to happen in Acts chapter 17, 18, and 19, where we see, you know, how they come into the city where taken away of something that they're preaching that they're raising money with, you know. So it kind of reminds me of setting that stage right now.
Yeah. Now, we haven't come to the time yet, that's a number of chapters ahead, where we see the great uproar in the stadium at Ephesus, right? That happens on the third preaching tour. But here, we see that essentially the same thing is happening. These people who have just now lost their method of gain because the demon was cast out of the slave girl now drag Paul and Silas before the magistrates in the public area. What did it say? The marketplace in verse 19. So they brought him into the marketplace. They say that that's where the rulers were. And then it says, and when they had brought them unto the magistrates, or the footnote says praetors is the Greek word. They said, these men being Jews do exceedingly trouble our city. So, once again, we're seeing, they say, these men trouble our city. These men teach those things which we as Romans aren't supposed to hold to. There's nothing here that says, well, they took away our money. So, but they drag them before the magistrates. We'll see that happens to Paul in other places. Even at the Areopagus, though they didn't take him before the magistrate, they really urged him to come with them and talk. It's almost like they dragged him along simply because they were interested, I suppose you might say, because the people in Athens had nothing better to do than see or tell some new thing, right? Was it Athens? I believe it was. Yeah, Randy?
I'm just thinking again from the standpoint of the owners of this slave girl. Nobody's ever done anything like this before. You know, cast out. What's their concept of a demon? All they know is they've got this girl that, who knows what the fortune-telling thing is. You know, how do they know?
Yeah.
Like Mickey was talking about if they purchased her from somebody else and she was for sale, because, hey, here's some hope of profit that you have. If you own this slave girl, you can take her to crowds and get people paying money to tell their fortunes or whatever. But they must have looked at what was done as a personal assault.
Assault.
This didn't have anything to do with the demon. This had to do with the assault against them.
Yeah.
What are you doing? And the other thing is what it says, after he commands the spirit to come out, it says it came out at that very moment. But we don't know if it was a visual thing. I can't imagine it being a visual. What's the evidence that it came out? She can't do that anymore.
Right. Yes. That's right.
So whatever she was doing, she's not doing anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's their accusation against him? He commanded, he said something to her, and all of a sudden she can't do it anymore. So their accusation is he said something?
Yeah. He said something. There we go.
He said something, now she can't do it anymore. So now that they have to make stuff up in front of the authorities.
Now, people haven't made things up before, have they?
It's kind of a running theme.
It is a running theme, isn't it? And it will continue to be a running thing in Paul's life throughout the next several chapters that we have here also.
And when they say these men are throwing our city into confusion, well, they threw those two guys, or three guys, however many guys were there,
right,
they made it throw them into confusion, but you don't see the whole city.
No. Whereas in Ephesus, that we'll get to in a few chapters, we see it's like the whole city was in uproar, and they're all in the stadium. Mickey.
On that, I think it's noteworthy that this objection starts with the folks who own this woman.
Yep.
And they get upset, they go to the rulers. Now, I've had to study to know, I don't recall if the rulers and the magistrates are the same or not. But they go to the rulers, and then it goes to the magistrates. And if you'll note in verse 22, after the accusation that they've set more customs unlawful for us to receive, it tells us that the multitude rose up together against them. So I don't know who all is included in the multitude, but they then appeared in the marketplace
right
to result of these owners. And so now we've got a whole multitude of folks that are objecting to Paul and Silas and what they're doing.
doesn't seem to take much to stir up a mob in this, exactly. These particular areas. They're standing around the marketplace waiting for something to do. Yeah, that's there probably were, and it says multitude, of course, and we are in the marketplace. Philippi being a relatively large city, so there could have been a lot of people there. Juan.
I wonder about the fact that, you know, now they know that she's not real. I mean, I would have to say that she probably was prophesizing is a bad probably word for this, but she was sitting there being a fortune teller, and it seemed to be true, because why else would they care? If it was like a scam, and she was lying anyways, they could continue having her lie. It wouldn't be a big deal, but it seems like it actually was some kind of fortune telling to be truthful, but as she was sitting there saying that they were of the Most High God. So, I mean, it's just kind of weird to me that I'm like, you guys could have just had her keep lying or making stuff up, but apparently it was probably pretty truthful as far as fortune telling goes, since the demon was doing whatever it wanted, but that's kind of weird to me that, like, they could have just kept the scam going probably without any real issue, but they really took offense to this.
Yeah, well, I have a response that probably James has, so go ahead, James, and then Carolyn.
Well, you know, Richard, when we look at, you know, on the other hand, when we look at modern times, many people have been deceived, for example, the Heaven's Gate cult. Group after group of people who claim to be some prophet, people follow and they drink the Kool-Aid and end up dead. Or they follow after things like communism, and you see where countries and people have ended up following certain things. So being deceived is easier than we think.
Yes.
And it's also somewhat easy to convince yourself of things that aren't true because you want to believe them bad enough so you're willing to abrade your conscience enough to the point that it doesn't exist anymore so you're willing to believe a lie. So one of the greatest deceptions is that it's not easy to be deceived when it really is.
It is easy to be deceived, yeah. Because usually being deceived is the easier way.
Yes.
Yes. Carolyn.
Talking about how they could tell that the demon was out of her, we see other occasions where somebody has a demon and they act crazy. You know, what's the one where they he beats up the seven sons? I can't think of.
Oh, Sceva. Yeah.
Sceva. And or somebody's running around with their clothes on. These different, you know, they act completely out of their mind.
Right.
And then when the demon is gone, they're calm again. And we don't know whether she was acting some other way, but to know that the demon came out immediately seems like there might have been some other evidence of how she was.
Right. She fixed her hair or something like that. Who knows? Yeah. So, yeah. So, Juan, I thought that perhaps that soon, because James' hand went up right away when you said something, that the thing is that the Scripture says that Paul cast a demon out of her. So therefore she did have a demon, and the things that she was doing were supernatural. Now, whether everything that she was saying was true, that's one thing. But the fact of the matter is that she did have a demon, and Paul cast that out. And so there apparently was some way that they could tell that she didn't have the demon anymore. Okay, James and then Bruce.
You know, Richard, just thinking about that further, you know, what you said and what Juan said, you know, thinking back to the time when Moses and Aaron went before Pharaoh. Pharaoh's magicians were able to throw a rod down and it became a snake. Now, Moses' rod, his snake, ate theirs, which showed the superiority of God's power. But there was some power that those magicians had back then, Pharaoh's magicians. So, you know, it may go one way or the other, but either way, what we see here is God's power overrules Satan and overrules everyone. And
yeah.
What they were doing with this young slave girl was wrong. It was dishonest. She was being taken advantage of. And it wasn't having her follow them around. It was not the way to preach the gospel.
No, right. Bruce?
You know, and it's amazing to me now, even though she was following them all this time, And what, you know, what she's saying here, you know, in the phrase that these men are servants of the Most High God, to show us the way to salvation. And then when they cast the demon out of her, we don't know what even happened, you know, to this lady, even after all of that. Now that all this happened, now we know what happened with the, what we call the, we know what happens to the jailer, you know, after all that. But does she become obedient to, you know, does she, you know, become obedient to Christ? You know, and, you know, this kind of amazes me because maybe she does. We just, you know, just speculate.
Yeah.
But still.
It'd be nice to think that she did because she saw, obviously she saw this miracle.
Yeah, well. But still, you know, she follows him, she stays with him, he was cast out. You know, was she one of the people who was even thrown in prison? Or was she one of the people who became obedient, you know, along with the Philippian jailer? You know, we don't know those things. You know, we don't know those things, but it's a great story.
Well, we know that, you know, Paul later wrote a book to the church of Philippi. We see that there was a church established there, and that's a good thing. All right. So we see that the mob ruled once again, and the accusations came before the magistrates. The magistrates felt that there must be something to this because I guess these other people that were the owners of this slave girl must have been some upstanding citizens or something. I don't know. But not only did they bring them before the magistrates, but it says here in verse 22 that the magistrates rent their garments off them and commanded to beat them with rods. So, there's a lot of beating going on here. And then they're thrown into jail. So we see that it's the magistrates themselves, apparently, that rip their clothing off of them. They do this because that makes the beating much more effective. But then, and that they commanded them to be beaten. Now, as we go through this and look at the beating here, the word that is used here in the Greek is a word that has to do with rods or sticks. And if you look it up, and look up the times that this is used in the New Testament, we'll see that this word is used here, and it's also used in 2 Corinthians, where 2 Corinthians 11:25, where Paul says that he was beaten, but the previous verse to that says that five times received I 40 stripes, saved one. There's a difference between stripes and beating. And the word lends itself to beating with a rod. It appears that the people that were doing the beating had like a bundle of rods that they would hold together. As a matter of fact, the symbol of their power, apparently, and we've seen it, I think, in movies or pictures or something where there's a bunch of sticks together and it's got an axe head at the top of it. It would indicate that they have the power not only to mete out corporal punishment, but also capital punishment. And so the lictors, I think is what they're called, are the people that have this, and they would have been the ones that actually did the beating. James and then Randy.
Couple of things. So that would be beatings with a rod then versus beatings or lashings with a cat of nine tails, which would have a far different effect on the body. Neither would feel very good.
No.
But also it seems like there's somewhat of a pattern of a lot of accusations and draggings and beatings and not a lot of trials or chance to make self-defense either.
That's true.
And you see the inconsistency when you study instances like this. You see Stephen, you see what happened with Jesus. Not a lot of people got a very fair shot to defend what they were doing.
Yep. And the Romans are the ones that actually essentially developed the system of justice that we have today. And we see that that's being violated here in Philippi. So, Randy.
You
That Randy, sorry.
The bundle of sticks with the axe in the middle. Those were called fasci, F-A-S-C-I, from which the fascists get their name.
Oh, yeah, sure, that's where, right.
And if you really want to, I mean, you obviously look it up on the internet. You've seen an old Mercury dime that was on the backside.
That's right.
They had one of those on them.
Okay, yeah, that's... I think that's where I remember seeing it. You know, my grandmother showed me the dime. I never saw it myself. Randy.
I was just going to say the New American Standard says beat with rods. Verse 22.
Okay.
It's proceeded to order them to be beaten with rods. What does yours say?
Beaten. Just beaten.
Just beaten. I'm just curious about that.
No. It says beat them with rods. Commanded to beat them with rods. Sorry.
The footnote says literally to beat with rods.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So, beaten with rods and literally beaten with rods. So, I think we've got it. It's rods. One other thing. If we look at the 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 11 part, in verse 24 where it says that the Jews five times received I 40 stripes save one. So, the Jewish law only permitted a person to be scourged for 40 stripes, right? What about the Roman law? No regulation there. So no telling how long they beat them. Obviously, they did not beat them to death. But apparently, they could have received a beating much more or less than what the Jews would have given them as a lashing. Now, if we look at the usages of this particular word that's used, sometimes it does mean things like lashings and stuff, but other times it just means a stick and so on. It's one of these generic words that's used for a lot of things in the Greek language. Randy?
I think that in this case, Paul took the beating without saying anything. The next time he's faced with receiving a beating, he then decides, wait a minute, I'm a Roman citizen.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, it could be this fact that he's older. It could have been he's been through this once. I really don't want to do it again. We can speculate all day long as to why he didn't hear and did then.
We do see that later on in this chapter. So that's they do bring it up, and that's one thing I want to discuss when we get down there is that the number of times that Paul used his Roman citizenship to the advantage of the gospel. So never used it really to spare himself, but rather to make sure that the gospel was able to be proclaimed in the proper way. All right. Well, when we look at beatings, though, I looked up a little bit about beatings here and looked at some of the things, some of the places where they occur in the New Testament. You'll remember in Acts, the 5th chapter in verse 40. Somebody look at Acts, 5th chapter in verse 40. Tell us what that has to say. Anybody got Acts 5:40?
To him they agreed when they called the apostles unto them. They beat them, charged them not to speak the name of Jesus in that building.
All right, so what's the context here?
Well, the apostles are being punished.
Right, and these are all the apostles. This is one with all the apostles, whereas two chapters before, it was just Peter and John. So here it's all of them, and it says there in verse 40, they took Gamaliel's advice that they shouldn't be found to be fighting against God, right? And they told them to stop this, and they beat them. Now, here it's not the same word, so it may be more of the Jewish beating with the cat of nine tails type thing. But they were beaten. Randy in the back.
In passing, I think it's important to note how they reacted to this. They counted them. They were glad that they were counted worthy to suffer.
Worthy, right? To suffer for the gospel's sake. So we see we see that the apostles, and this was before, of course, Paul's time, the apostles were beaten by their own brethren here and told not to preach in this guy's name again. Do you want to say something before I go on? And then if we go on to Acts, the 21st chapter and verse 32, you remember Acts chapter 21, James is what?
Before the mob.
Before the mob. Okay, so they're in the temple area and they're before the, what's the mob doing? Beating them. It says that in Acts 21:32, it says, and forthwith he took soldiers. This is the what's his name? I can't remember his name. Anyway, the man who wrote the letter. Pardon?
Claudius
Lysias. Yeah, he took soldiers and centurions and ran down upon them, and they, when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, left off beating Paul. So here we're talking about probably fisticuffs and things like that. The people are enraged that Paul supposedly brought a Gentile into the temple, which he didn't do, of course. And so they were beating him. And then we've already looked at 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, and verse 24 and 5, where it talks about receiving lashings from the Jews five times, and three times he was beaten with rods. So here we have one right here in Acts chapter 16, where he was beaten with rods. And then in Acts 22, just as a comparison, Acts 22 and 19 through 20, where Paul is making a defense. Acts 22 is what, James? All right, so he's making his defense at that time before the Sanhedrin. Pardon, 22. 20. Say what?
22, 19,
and 20? Uh-oh, our expert let us down.
I'm in trouble now.
Yes, you are.
I repent.
You repent. Okay. All right. So, 22 is in front of the... Oh, this is up on the steps in front of the people. Okay. All right. And so here, somebody read 19 and 20. Who's got 19 and 20? Randy, in front, do you have that? No? Oh, oh, Bruce, go ahead.
And I said, Lord, to those, they themselves know that I was in prison and beaten every synagogue, then they believed me, And with the blood of Stephen, and my witness, shall shed, and I also stand by, consenting and keeping the garments of them that slew them.
All right, so Paul says in his defense to the people on the stairway up to the palace or whatever it's called, he says, they themselves know that I imprisoned and beat in every synagogue them that believed on thee. He's recounting his discussion with Jesus on the road to Damascus. And I think, isn't that what it is? Yeah. Yeah, but so we see here that Paul is familiar with beatings, not only now, but he will be in the future. He was on the first journey. He didn't receive a beating, but he was in what happened to him in Lystra.
Stoned.
He was stoned, right? So Paul is familiar with persecution, physical persecution, based on the preaching of the gospel. James.
You know, Richard, because I've trained in martial arts most of my whole life, when I think about these beatings, if you take, for example, a cut, that's why boxers put Vaseline on their face so a glove will hopefully slip off if you get hit. A cut heals at about 1% a day. Most mixed martial arts fighters wait at least 3 months in between matches because your body needs time to heal. These aren't situations where these people were in one-on-one situations where they could fight back. At best, a highly trained person might be able to handle three, possibly four people if they're not well trained. But when you talk about getting lynched by a mob, you're done, that's it. And then getting tied up, put in stocks, beaten, lashed, probably no decent medical treatment other than maybe having water poured on your back and a dirty robe put over you. These people took serious beatings for the cause of the truth. And when we talk about, pray about, asking God to wear us out in His service, do we really get
beaten
severely. You've got to wonder what their condition was at the time and how through faith they had to push on to accomplish this mission of preaching the gospel.
When
they took beatings, this was bad.
So it's not a light thing, even though Paul mentioned that it was a light thing later on. Okay, Mickey and then Noah.
Well, just a simple point. That Paul not only knew how to dish it out, he had received it many times.
Yes, he had.
He knew what it was to be beaten, and he knew what it was to beat.
He regretted the fact that he had done that, and he mentions it several times that he regretted the kind of person that he was in the past. But he received the same thing. Noah.
I was just thinking of the power of the Holy Spirit in him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you think. All right. I have an actual photograph of them in the stocks here. So they were imprisoned after this beating, and they were thrown into the prison. And the jailer was told to keep them safely, as it were. And he put them in the inner prison, which was more probably like a dungeon. In other words, underground or something like that. Now, of course, this, I guess this is supposed to be them singing. I don't know. They look more like they're in agony than singing, but I think that's probably what it's supposed to be. But one thing, well, somebody mentioned, I think it's in the commentary, the Truth commentary, talking about stocks, is that they put holes all along here. And to make it much more comfortable for people, they would put one foot here and they put another foot over here. Okay. These were not things just to keep them in place. They could be kept in place by putting chains on them. They put them in stocks to punish them. And so that's we of course see in history a lot of use of stocks and things like that. We think mostly they're just like this. Well, we just put them there and they're just restrained. That's not necessarily the case. We see the one where the witch hunts in Salem and things like that, where they put them in the city square, where they actually had their head through and their hands through also. That was, you ended up having to support yourself. You know, here in stocks, you're apparently, what they're showing is sitting down. It's most likely what they were. But it probably wasn't something quite as comfortable as this looks. A couple of other pictures I saw, They had straw underneath them, had blankets on. I thought, yeah, I don't think so.
No.
Do you remember any history about in that era of time how prisons worked? In other words,
if
you were a prisoner and nobody was going to bring you food and water, you ended up starving because it was up to somebody who knew you, your family or something, to bring you the food and the water. Now, whether they gave you a minimal amount or not, I don't know. But if you look at some of these things on BBC America, I'm trying to remember what the name of it. There's one soap opera that's going on right now that where they threw somebody in prison, you know, and everybody in there had typhoid. You know, he ended up with typhoid also. And, you know, you go in these things and all this, these horrible conditions and things like that, and you think, well, and that was in the 1600s, and this is way back in the 0 hundreds. You know, the conditions were probably pretty horrible.
Prison
was definitely prison at that time. When they, when they took the prophet in Samaria, was it, and dropped him down into the hole in the muck?
The Old Testament,
was it Jeremiah? Yeah. Seemed like there was another one also. But, I mean, they just dropped him down in there, and it was just goo down in the bottom of the hole. Oh, yeah.
To the extent of nearly dying.
That's right. So, yeah.
It also adds a little bit of a meaning to what Jesus said in Matthew 25 about those that visited him in prison.
Okay, visited him in prison.
He wasn't just going and talking to him on the other side of a piece of glass. How are you doing?
Yeah.
Or, hey, how you doing? It was taking care of their needs.
True. That's right. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. All right. So next week we'll talk about the jailer and his household. And if we get through it expeditiously, we could start the questions, which I have right here if you don't have them. They're right here on the front pew to remind myself to let you know that they're here. All right. Thank you.